Hi, everyone. Again, this is Christina Galupski of the Brookings Institution. I'm the Communications Manager in the Global Economy and Development Program. Welcome to our media briefing. Before we get started, I'd just like to remind you, if you're not speaking, to please mute your phone so we can make sure that we can hear whoever is talking at that time. Also, just a reminder, this call is on the record. We are recording it, and we will have a transcript available after, probably early tomorrow morning. So if you would, I'll make sure to email it to everyone, and it'll also be on the Brookings website. In general, the call is going to be organized like this. Amar Bhattacharya is going to give a 2-minute introduction. Timmons Roberts is going to follow up. Then Amar will speak again for 5 minutes, and followed by Adele Morris. A quick introduction to our panel today. Amar Bhattacharya is a senior fellow here at the Global Economy and Development Program at Brookings. Timmons Roberts is a non-resident senior fellow also in the Global Program and is the Idelson Professor of Environmental Studies and Sociology at Brown University. And Adele Morris is a senior fellow and the Policy Director for the Climate and Energy Economics Project in the Economic Studies Program, also here at Brookings. If we could just go around the call and any reporters, if you could identify yourselves, that would be really great.
Hi, it's Will Malden with the Wall Street Journal.
It's Ben Wolfgang with the Washington Times.
Nancy Benek, Associated Press.
Lonnie Johnson with the Financial Times.
Colleen Nelson. Wall Street Journal.
Andy Revkin, New York Times.earth blog.
Great. Anyone else? All right, fantastic. I'm going to turn it over to you, Amar.
Okay, great. Thanks, Christina. Hi, this is Amar Bhattacharya. So as we all know, we're going to have a very major summit on climate in Paris. And it is, in our view, a kind of a milestone, not just because it's one of many COPs, it's COP21 as it's called, but because we do believe that it's actually a transformative moment. And we have prepared, as you will see from our website, 12 essays commenting on different parts of that agenda. It talks about why Paris is different and what the promise of Paris is. It talks about the key issues, particularly a very important issue that my colleague Adele will talk about, the pricing of carbon. And it talks about the positions of the major players. And of particular significance is that unlike previous such events, the force and the leadership is coming from the two largest emitting countries, the United States and China. So that's really the context. That's all I wanted to say by way of introduction, and let me turn it over to Timmons.
Thanks, Amar. This is Timmons Roberts. Again, I'm at Brown University. I have a group of students and postdoctoral researchers called the Climate and Development Lab, and we have a webpage called climatedevlab.org, and on there is some of our recent work, and we're putting up some more. I have a book that's just come out recently called Power in a Warming World, The New Global Politics of Climate Change and the Remaking of Environmental Inequality, that's co-authored, and another one about Latin America and the global politics of climate change, and those are both at MIT Press, just if you want to read a lot more. And I'm sure with the COP coming next week, you'll probably crunch for time. So just I'm supposed to talk for about 4 or 5 minutes, and what I'm going to talk about is whether 2015 is different. And when I mean different, I especially wanted to compare it with 2009, the Copenhagen negotiations, which were also seen as sort of the last best chance to address this existential crisis of climate change. So is 2015 different? It's very different. There's been quite a lot of geopolitical reshuffling, and we are in a sort of a more multipolar world where really the China has risen quite a lot. If you look at the amount of emissions of greenhouse gases, China is now over 30% of the world total. The United States is about 16, so China is probably almost double ours, and if you add the two of them up, you have about half the problem. So one of the big things that is different this year, it really has been China and the U.S. Starting to work together, as Amar said, the first time was in November 2014 with a joint announcement of quite differentiated actions with China, you know, announcing a peak year in 2030 by which it would peak to stop increasing its emissions increase. And the U.S. announcing, you know, basically with the Obama administration announcing that it would meet its 26 to 28% emissions reduction targets by 2025. So totally different kinds of targets, but both showing that basically half the world's emissions were going to be controlled really for the first time. And Copenhagen was important, of course, because it was supposed to be the deadline for coming up with a replacement for the Kyoto Protocol, which, you know, ran out in 2012, and at least the first commitment period. And as most of you remember and know, the U.S. never ratified Kyoto, and in fact, it was unsigned early in the George W. Bush administration. So really, the largest emitter in the world was not part of the Kyoto Protocol, and that was a big part of its one of its failings. So we were living in a much more multipolar world where problems like climate change have to be addressed in a much different way, a much more multilateral way. We can't bully really the world to do exactly what we want. It's no longer a top-down solution either. The Kyoto Protocol was at least a set of binding targets by the 35 richest countries agreeing back in 1997 in Kyoto to reduce their emissions by about 5%. The solution that's come really since Copenhagen has been this bottom-up or pledge and review system where countries offer what they want to, what they think they are able to offer in terms of reducing their emissions. And those pledges this year has been, in some ways, the Paris year has already been a success in that over 160 countries have submitted these things called INDCs, or Intended Nationally Determined Contributions, to the United Nations. They're all on the UNFCCC website, and they can be added up. And so sort of what do they add up to? We thought we were headed towards about 4 degrees centigrade of warming, which is up in the range of 7 degrees Fahrenheit. And now, and of course, the safe levels are probably around under 2 degrees or maybe even under 1.5 degrees centigrade of warming. So we have a long way to go. So at the beginning of this year, by some calculations, we were expected to warm to about 3.6 degrees. And then after this year, it's looking like about, if you add up all the pledges, and depending on how you model this, comes to about 2.7 degrees. So we've reduced the expected warming by almost a degree from 3.6 to 2.7. So the first question is that enough? And the answer is probably not. In fact, it's really does put us over the edge into dangerous climate change. On the other hand, is it a major achievement for 1 year of pledges? The answer is absolutely yes. The other thing to remember is that Paris really is not the end of negotiations, but a beginning of a whole new sort of regime, a system by which countries will come back every 5 years and make new pledges in a new cycle every 5 years. And there's supposed to be a ratchet mechanism by which countries' pledges must get more ambitious each 5 years and can't slip backwards. So I think Paris has been a pretty big deal. And these INDCs are the intended nationally determined contributions in that baggy UN language. I'll say pledges for short. At least are, to me, look very sort of surprisingly pragmatic, that even some developing countries that have resisted being part of making emissions reductions because they believe very strongly that the rich countries should go first, have come in with meaningful pledges. They're all very different. They're highly variable in their ambition. But they do at least come in with pledges, and they, as I said, together they add up to some meaningful reductions. And there are some good, there's the Climate Action Tracker online, has some good ranking of the quality of those in terms of their ambition. That is, are they really doing enough? There's another review called the Civil Society Review, and the of these INDCs, the pledges, and that pays a lot of attention to, you know, sort of who caused the problem, not just the amount of the emissions reductions. So just to wind up, I want to talk about five tailwinds for this year for Paris. And I will admit that there are headwinds also happening this year in 2015, but I think there are five things that make 2015 different as well that are positive things that in my piece in the Brookings briefing I talk about, and I have been described as pretty optimistic, and I'm willing to listen, of course, to the cautions, and I think they are real, but I think there's important things that we should hope that this is a good year. So the first is that people are perceiving climate change themselves in a different way than they did even just 6 years ago. For example, in the Northeast before Hurricane Sandy hit, before this record-breaking couple of years of warm summers and warm years, and then in general, we did a little analysis in Rhode Island showing that summers are now, on average, 2.5 to 3 weeks longer than they used to be, that is, number of days over 80 degrees. So I think people are perceiving climate change. They don't have to just believe the scientists anymore. They can feel it. They notice it. Now, the second tailwind is that the economy is better. Remember that 2009, the economy was pretty much in free fall from the Great Recession. Especially the wealthy countries were dropping, and those, of course, were the countries that were needed most to be the leaders. There are still countries now that are not doing so well. They're important, sort of footnotes here, but the larger global economy is on a much more stable footing than it was in 2009. A third tailwind is the wind itself. That is, the price of renewables is dropping steadily and quite quickly, and faster than most people thought. So right now, wind power, onshore wind, is at grid parity, meaning that it is cost the same price to put onto the electric grid as is coal in some places in the United States, and is as cheap as natural gas in places as well. And solar electricity is dropping into the area of grid parity as well, and it's expected by 2020 to be below the cost and much more stable, of course, as the price will not be as volatile as fossil fuels. And carbon pricing will make a difference, too, that Adele will talk about in a minute. Fourth tailwind is the Pope. Pope Francis has been an unexpectedly disruptive agent on climate change this year, tying the issue to social justice, to morals, to spirituality, and really saying that we all have to act on this and that we need to treat it as an issue of justice, that the developed countries really need to act first on this. And I think part of what his speeches have done, and his encyclical Laudato Si, released back in June, I believe, has really made it impossible for more critical people to just easily dismiss this issue. And on the other hand, I think he really has touched people in a different way on the issue and reached across faiths to create a movement of churches and synagogues and temples on the issue of climate change and to support this issue. There's already a movement called Interfaith Power and Light that I talked about in another blog for Brookings a while back. And then the fifth tailwind is really this, the five countries that got together in Copenhagen and created the Copenhagen Accord are finally moving. We have Brazil, South Africa, India, and China, and the U.S., who created the Copenhagen Accord, have really now have to show that the system that they put in place back in Copenhagen is one that can work, that can actually deliver emissions reductions on a scale on the scale of the problem at hand. So there's been the U.S. joint announcement. There was another joint announcement in September 2015. There's been Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff coming to announce climate plans with Obama and with Angela Merkel. Rajendra Modi in India visited with Xi Jinping and with Obama and has been surprisingly sort of forward-leaning on climate change and so on. So you get the idea that there's sort of mini-lateralism and bilateralism going on. That's, I think, meant in the spirit of supporting the multilateralism in the UN process. So there's an understanding that we need a strong global agreement, but really that these are the kind of players that need to act. And in 2009, it wasn't really clear how this group would work together. Now, just to finish, I would say there is a big crunch looming out there, and that is the atmospheric space. That is how much more carbon can be put in the atmosphere. We have a lot of unburnable carbon in the ground in the form of oil, gas, and coal, and that most of it has to stay down there. And if we look ahead, we're headed for sort of a collision course on this, and I'm happy to talk more about that. But my point would be really that this is the reason why we have to pay attention to equity in the negotiations, that much of the rest of the world, the 5 billion people that aren't in the EU, the US, or China, will be left behind if we don't come up with an ambitious and equitable deal. So I will leave it there and pass it over to Adele.
Actually, Amar is going to go next. Thank you so much, though, Timmons.
Okay, sure.
Thanks. Let me just a word on Paris, building on what Timmons said. So there are three deliverables in Paris, as it were. The first is what came before Paris, which are the intended nationally determined contributions. 162 countries have so far filed such INDCs. The second is that the Paris COP21 will seek to agree on a new multilateral instrument. And what's important about it is that it will apply to all countries, that it will try to set out a transparent and verifiable monitoring mechanism, and it will also try to agree on the means of implementation, which means finance, technology, and capacity building. And particularly the third part will focus on the commitment made at Copenhagen to try and come up with 100 billion per year by 2020, which were promised by rich countries to help poorer countries make the transition to low carbon development and to become more resilient. So as Timmons said, Paris will, important as though the initial contributions are, will fall far short of the actions needed to keep us in the safe zone. So what's really needed is that, to put us on a virtuous cycle of action which we can build on Paris, and where all countries, step up their ambitions and international cooperation supports those ambitions. So one central aspect of this is the building of infrastructure. In the next, two decades, the world will probably need to build about as much infrastructure as we have in the current infrastructure stock right now. What's different about it is the nature of that infrastructure. In advanced economies, a lot of the infrastructure building is the replacement of aging infrastructure, but therein lies an opportunity to replace that infrastructure with better infrastructure. But the bulk of the infrastructure will be in emerging markets and developing countries, especially other than China, which of course has been building a lot of infrastructure. In the next 30 years, some 3 billion people will be moving to cities in the developing world, and huge needs for energy, for transport corridors, and for water and waste management. So when you look at that, there's a big need in terms of physical investment, but there's also a great opportunity to ensure that this investment is much better than the infrastructure of the past. So what we have to see Paris about is how do you use the Paris opportunity to get agreement on a new approach, And that new approach has to be centered around better public policy, better financing, addressing the fundamental distortions in prices, especially on carbon pricing, and finally on kind of getting a lot more out of innovation. In recent discussions, as you know, we have seen in the past, there is still a mistaken view that there is a fundamental conflict between acting on climate and growth and development. And as Timmons pointed out, the evidence that is coming in is actually we can have our cake and eat it too. Not only can we have a low carbon transition, but it may turn out that this is growth enhancing rather than growth diminishing, although in the short run, there will be trade-offs involved. And, you know, the trick is how do you design smart policy, and particularly how do you bring down the costs of financing, because the costs of financing are a very big impediment towards taking the more sustainable and the better choice. So let me stop there and, you know, switch to Adele to talk about the pricing of carbon.
Thanks, Amar, and thanks to all of you on the line for your coverage of the climate change issue. I really appreciate you joining this call. My research on climate and energy derives from my role as an economist and public finance economist, as well as natural resource economist. And so from my perspective, we're not really serious about climate policy until we're talking about the fundamental market shifts necessary to drive the economy in a more emissions efficient direction. Starting from that perspective, you know, I look at the outcomes of COP21 in Paris as potentially a stepping stone of more productive ways of engaging other countries in more transparent and effective climate agreements. We keep talking about COP21 as a negotiation, but in actual fact, these intended nationally determined contributions aren't being negotiated at all. More accurately, they're being stapled together along with agreements on other dimensions of the climate problem, namely the finance that Amar talked about. But they're not really intended to be a negotiation. And so in that sense, it's kind of a diplomatic stapling exercise and not really the kind of contingent back and forth that really characterized a true negotiation. The challenge with these commitments, among others, is that they're really hard to compare. They're economically opaque, and they don't really talk about the actual policies in detail that countries will use to achieve their goals. And this challenge is illustrated, I think, by the United States as well. So the Obama administration put forward an ambitious INDC, and there are studies that show that, in principle, the U.S. could meet these targets, but it requires an assumption that the regulations under the Clean Air Act move forward without any interruption or delay or revision in the stringency of the state-level targets. And so the challenge for the U.S. delegation, among others, is to try to build the case that the U.S. INDC is credible, even while over a dozen states are suing the EPA over the provisions of that regulation. And it's also vulnerable, of course, to the leadership of the next administration. And as far as I can tell, I think all of the Republican candidates have declared their opposition to the Clean Power Plan. And so that kind of makes it a challenge, rhetorically at least, for the U.S. to commit significantly to the targets that it's announced. I think some of the good things, though, that are going to come out of COP21, as Amar said, is a collective notion of progress, where it's not just the developed countries taking the bulk of responsibility, and that is scientifically a useful shift, because obviously the buildup of greenhouse gases and projections are likely to be largely owing to developing countries becoming more developed. I guess I want to stop before I get in too much detail, but I do want to call your attention to the paper in that collection of papers that Brookings has put out. And in that paper, my co-authors and I argue that what we really need is a much smaller group of countries to get together and talk about pricing carbon, and as a first step, focus on the technical and administrative aspects of carbon pricing and build confidence around those discussions and comparable methodologies for reporting on carbon pricing, and then eventually evolve to what I think would be a much more fruitful negotiating forum of major emitters in a much smaller, less unwieldy process to focus on carbon prices, much as we focus on tariffs in the trading negotiation context. So I'll stop there, and I'll welcome your questions.
Thanks so much, Adele, Amar, and Timmons. We will go to your questions now. I ask that you please identify yourself before you speak. So we'll start taking questions.
Andy Refkin here. I was hoping Timmons could talk about one of the potential disruptors, I don't mean protests, but disruptive questions in these talks, is on the financing of developing country energy and resilience initiatives. You know, there's going to be a big fight over how concrete, if you talk about the concrete nature, the amorphous nature of the INDCs, but on the developing country side, they're demanding much more concrete, measurable, reportable, verifiable, you know, proof that the rich countries are actually going to pay up on some of these things. And the secondary thing is loss and damage. How big an issue do you see this as being at the talk?
Yeah, thanks, Andy. Those are great questions. So financing is always the something that's offered to sort of break the stalemate. It's been offered, you know, sort of new and additional climate finance was offered in 92 in Rio, and then in, you know, as part of Kyoto, and the basic idea is that the poor countries largely did not create the problem, but they have to deal with the impacts, and they're much less able to do so. So the financing is quite important to have their participation, especially sort of their enthusiastic participation. It's as you say, it's an open question. Really, it's going to be interesting to see how it's dealt with. I think there are different options on the table. It's not very clear yet how we will, you know, make a roadmap to the $100 billion promise, as Amar pointed out. I have a group called Adaptation Watch, a network of different NGOs and universities around the world. We're releasing a report in a couple of days in which we are going to call for a one-year work program for really developing a system for categorizing and accounting for and tracking climate finance, because it's remarkable that in spite of these pledges being made many times in the past, there's never been a really independent system and agreed system on what counts as meeting those targets and how who gets to decide that and how we get to know that it's actually been delivered. So I think really the tracking and accounting is huge on this issue and could go a long way. And it also helps by having these clear systems that would follow the money all the way from the donor country or contributor country, you know, from taxpayers to aid agencies to, you know, international development banks to implementing agencies to, you know, communities and watchdogs and think tanks and universities and so on, that there should be a way for all this information to get into one system. So I think there's an opportunity really for a quantum leap on transparency of climate finance, and I think it could make a huge difference. So on loss and damage, so for those who don't know, that's the idea that there are certain things you can adapt to, and then there's certain things that are just beyond the adaptation, that if the sea level rise is just too high and it's just beyond too expensive to adapt, then there's just going to be damage. So the least developed countries especially pushed for, and the small island states pushed for this mechanism agreed 2 years ago in Warsaw, the Warsaw International Mechanism on Loss and Damage. And all it basically says so far is that this will be studied. And so in the Paris text that came out of Bonn in October, the latest Bonn negotiations, there are two options, and one includes this, you know, a few items about loss and damage. It doesn't really say much. It just says that it'll be worked out over the next 4 years. So it's kind of kicking it down the road. And then the other option is that there should be no mention at all of loss and damage. So I am hopeful that that first option will satisfy both sides. It's not a great piece of text, but it's something that will make the developing countries feel like this issue is at least being kept on the map, and then the developed countries can live with it because it's not very binding or very clear on where it has to go.
May I add something to that? So, yeah. I mean, the difference in terms of the perspective is from the developing country side, the definition that was sort of preferred was that A, it should be public money, and B, that it should really be concessional money. But, what has been very clearly stipulated is that it's not that. It's actually money from all sources, public and private, and that it will be, leveraged as well as direct money. I think it's important to look at this $100 billion, in perspective of the financing needs that I was talking about. When you look at how much is needed for financing of sustainable infrastructure, we're not talking in the billions, we are talking in the trillions. The total amount of financing that will be needed for sustainable infrastructure on an annual basis is going to be somewhere between $3.5 and $5 trillion. So a very large number. What the $100 billion has to be looked at in the perspective of is how do you use that to wag, this larger dog, in fact, make that financing more attractive and the ultimate investments more sustainable. That's from a public policy point of view what is needed. But, of course, in the negotiations, what tends to get highlighted is very much the counting, which is important. But ultimately, what is more important is delivering on the quality of infrastructure and the quality of financing.
Thank you very much. Do we have another question?
This is Nancy Benning from the AP. I just wondered if you had a sense of what the president's role would be in Paris beyond giving a speech. Any expectations of what he'll be doing there?
Adele, do you think you can shed some light?
I think he's there kind of as a cheerleader for U.S. interests. He's got I think that things will go smoothly with regard to the acceptance of the INDCs, and I think he'll be there kind of just to show his support for the global climate effort. I'm not sure how much more the U.S. can promise, it's not my sense that he's there to break some logjam around the negotiations, but rather to show his interest and support of the issue.
I would just jump in to say that I think he's that is definitely the case, that he's there to show that this is an important issue, that the U.S. is behind a strong agreement and so on. But I think there's going to be a lot of issues still to be worked out. The 51-page text coming out of Bonn is filled with brackets. That is, unagreed text. And there's big issues still on the table. And really the role of the heads of state are to do at least some of the knocking down of the things that are the most thorny issues for their lead negotiators and ministers to work out after they leave, because they'll just be there the first day. But I think there will be some bilaterals and maybe some multilateral, minilateral meetings.
I also think the dynamics this time around are different. I mean, one of the issues that the U.S. has been pushing very hard on is for a verifiable mechanism. And it is quite instructive that China has signaled its support for that. So the kind of usual divisions that we have often seen in the past, not there. I tend to agree that one issue that remains will probably go down to the wire is the issue of financing, because there's still quite a lot of lack of clarity, not only about, you know, in terms of where money will come from, but also about, you know, what exactly will it be used for.
And in that sense, I would say that to some extent the president's hands are tied. I don't detect any significant willingness on the part of the U.S. Congress to appropriate large amounts of money to the Green Climate Fund or other related lines of finance. So if anything, he'll be going to some extent to push back on unrealistic expectations, however justified they might be, by other countries for large transfers, particularly from the United States.
Thank you. Is there another question?
I have another one. It's Andy, if no one else is ready. Anyone else? No? All right, well, I'll just ask. You know, Europe has held firm in the idea that there'll be some binding instruments, some aspect of this that will be legally binding. Obviously, it won't include targets and timetables, which was the longstanding wish of a lot of enviros and, you know, a lot of us over the years. But there is probably some legally binding thing. It seems like it's more like the instruments or the reporting methods, and this all builds out of the language in the Rio Treaty anyway. Do you see that as a sticking point, this demand or tension over what's binding or not?
Well, my sense of it is that, you know, this has now become more of a semantic issue because, you know, since nobody's talking about, first of all, you have to recognize that these INDCs are apples and oranges. Some of the commitments are being made, you know, respect to a business as usual scenario, others, you know, with regard to intensity of carbon to output. So, you know, it's difficult to aggregate these in any way that's really truly comparable. So I think, you know, this is not Kyoto. This doesn't have that kind of bindingness. Second, as we heard, the aim is actually to keep the room to ratchet up these ambitions through these regular reviews. So the most important part of, you know, what could have been binding is not. As you said, I mean, the part that, you know, people are trying to get a formal agreement on is the monitoring mechanism, that there would be a monitoring mechanism and that it would be binding in the sense that it would apply to all. But, you know, if you are not in adherence to it, what does it mean? And I personally don't think it, you know, it would be binding in the sense it is like the WTO or whatever, that there are any sanctions. And the final part, which is, you know, the means of implementation, it would be very, very difficult to make those binding as well because so much of that is voluntary. So, yes, Europe is very keen, you know, to get something that they call a legally binding instrument. You know, the U.S. has pushed back. Many emerging markets and developing countries have pushed back. I think in the substance of an agreement and, you know, on an instrument seem fairly imminent, you know, but as, a lot of the devil now is in the detail rather than on reaching agreement on an instrument.
Okay. I have one last quick follow-up, if I could. And maybe if that was Timmons, you could add this to what you're going to say. My overarching sense, having tracked this since before Rio, is that the real big turning point here is that since Copenhagen through now, the process has evolved less around an end point and more around to the reality that it's kind of normalized. It's becoming what David Victor in 1991 in a paper wrote, more like GATT than like the Montreal Protocol, for example. it's, you know, something we do. We work on trade perennially, and we work on climate perennially, both resilience and emissions. And is that a correct way to interpret what we're seeing here? This is, there'll be a COP 41, COP 61, and it's actually normal and good.
I would love to hear what Tim has to say, but, you know, I haven't been associated with this since 1991, but I certainly think that it has turned into a process, which in my view is a good thing, because it allows for, you know, for an improvement and of understanding, and it also allows much more for cooperative action rather than one party versus the other.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, I guess I would just go ahead, Adele.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I was a negotiator for the United States in COP6, in which the talks broke down. This was in 2000 at the very end of the Clinton administration, right before President Bush took office and withdrew the United States from the protocol. And in those sorts of what I think of as kind of big bang negotiations, the sense is that there's an overwhelming importance to this one meeting where certain critical issues have to get hammered out or there's a tremendous lost opportunity. And I think we've moved from that to what you described as more of a process, more of it being normal to meet routinely both in the larger COP and hopefully also in parallel processes in smaller groups with different topics of focus, and this sense of continuous improvement in the commitments, both in terms of their environmental ambition and their accountability, their comparability, and their transparency. And I think that transition is necessary to make progress. I'm not sure if it's sufficient, but I think it's been a long time coming, and it's a good thing.
Yeah, I'll just agree that it's becoming normalized, as you said, Andy, and it's the successful negotiations are often those with the lowest expectations. So I guess I'm a little worried that we have very high expectations for Paris. I guess that's kind of implied in what you're saying, Adele. So I think it will be a long time. I've been going for 12 years. I think I started going in 2003. And it's daunting to think about a COP 20 or COP 40 or COP 61. But it's, you know, it's that big of an issue, and I'm sure it will keep going. On the last thing on the non-binding, I was just going to say that Obama has at least been clear that the U.S. is not able to agree to a binding commitments in certain areas. So I think, it was a bit surprising that issue came up again. And I think it'll have to be resolved in a non-binding way for the U.S. to be part of it. And the world needs the U.S. to be part of it. And I think many other countries will only agree to something that's non-binding, you know, sort of formally on these targets and timetables.
Thank you. Hey.
Thanks very much. Do we have another question? All right, great. If we don't have any more questions, we can end right now. Again, my name is Christina Golubsky. I'm a communications manager here at Brookings. And if you have any more questions, you can call me at 202-797-6247. We're going to put this audio and the transcript on the Brookings website afterwards. And I have all of your names who checked it, who said they're here in the morning. I'll make sure I email you specifically. And other than that, I want to thank our panel again for their great insights on the upcoming climate change conference. After that, I'll say happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks much.
Happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.